Dear friends of Jesus Christ, yesterday, a week ago Saturday, Carol and I met with Maria Stewart and Vince Jasinski for lunch. As you know, if you were here last week, they have left Michigan and are going to live on a boat and explore ocean sailing and perhaps even take a trip around the world. Anyway, we had gotten together to sort of make a farewell out of it, and we had barely sat down when Maria gave me a package. I opened it, and it was a quilt. And I said, "Oh, how nice. Thank you." Now, fortunately, my wife was with me, because as she opened the quilt, she went on and on about, "Oh, how beautiful, Maria. This must have taken you months of time. Where did you get the design? It's like a stained glass window. It is lovely." And so she went on and on. Now, at that point, I realized, of course, that I had not fully appreciated the gift. I mean, it was hand-pieced, hand-appliqued, and hand-quilted. 10 stitches per inch. Afterwards, in the car, Carol said, "Do you realize that that must have taken hundreds of hours?" I mean, that is painstaking, eye-straining work. It is a work of art. It's a work of love. Now, there are times, I think, where we receive gifts and at first glance do not fully appreciate them. I mean, that little experience at lunch reminded me of one of my favorite movies, Babette's Feast. If you've seen it, you know that a woman prepares this meal for the villagers. And at the beginning, no one really understands the significance of what they're eating, except for this army officer. He knows that this is a rare treat, and that it is offered at great expense. But there are other gifts, common gifts, that are yet extraordinary. The gift of life, the gift of parents. I mean, we say our perfunctory thank yous, but it hardly ever really sinks in what the gift entails. And so I was thinking, on Easter Sunday, we're here to celebrate another gift, Christ's resurrection. And one of the reasons why we come together on Easter Sunday is to simply listen to the scriptures, the sermon, the songs, the hymns, the testimonies, to listen to all of that so that we might get just a better glimpse, a better understanding, a greater appreciation for this gift, Jesus' resurrection. Now, what you notice, of course, from Matthew's account is that no one was expecting a gift. That's one of the nice things about gifts. They come as a surprise. And the greater the surprise, the greater the amazement at the gift that is given. The women, we are told, as the first day of the week was dawning, go to see the tomb, not the risen Lord. They go to see the tomb. And then Matthew says, suddenly there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descending from heaven came, rolled back the stone, and sat on it, regal-like, king of the mountain. His appearance was like lightning, and his clothing white as snow. For fear of him, the guards shook and became like dead men. But the angel said to the women, not to the guards, but to the women, "Do not be afraid. I know that you are looking for Jesus who was crucified." And then comes the gift. "He is not here, for he has been raised, as he said. Come and see the place where he lay. And then go quickly and tell his disciples he has been raised from the dead and indeed is going ahead of you to Galilee, where you will see him." So that's the gift. This is my message for you. Now the response, the receiving. And so they left the tomb quickly with fear and great joy and ran to tell the disciples. Suddenly Jesus met them and said, "Greetings." And they came to him, took hold of his feet, and worshipped him. Then Jesus said to them, "Do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee. There they will see me." The gift and the receiving of the gift. I'd like to say just a little about either, both of those. Let's begin with the gift. The gift, and I got to tell you, it's beyond any one sermon to totally unwrap or unpack this gift. Even what we're told here contains too much for one sermon. So I'll just take the first two phrases. The verse says, let's see, where is this? Verses 7, he has been raised. No. 6, he is not here, for he has been raised, as he said. And what I'd like to do is to simply turn those two around and begin with, for he has been raised, and then say something about he is not here. He has been raised. Think about that. In the Greek, these four English words is just one word. Agathe. Agathe. He has been raised. And the truth of the matter is, on that little word, the whole gospel, like an inverted pyramid, rests. So that if that word is false, the whole Christian edifice collapses and deserves to collapse because it would be based on a lie. A person who is dead is not alive. But if it is true, then everything begins to fall into place. For he has been raised. I don't know how many of you had a chance to read the latest issue of Newsweek. The lead story is the story entitled, From Jesus to the Christ. And then very much in the introduction, there's this observation made by the writer, and he must be a believer, because he says, without the resurrection, it is virtually impossible to imagine this band of Jesus followers to survive. It is virtually impossible without the resurrection. And then he goes on, and for pages, one wonders how it is that this Jesus, this prophet in Israel, becomes the savior of billions of people around the world. Well, the answer is always found in that central claim. He has been raised. The resurrection. And what's interesting here is it's in the passive voice. He has been raised. You know, we sometimes sing, he arose, but he did not arise. He was dead. He has been raised. Over and over, if you read all the Gospels, this section from Romans, if you read the great sermon that Peter preaches on Pentecost, over and over again, the claim is made that God raised Jesus from the dead. And the significance of that is this, that in the resurrection of Jesus, God gives Jesus his thumbs up. His heaven's yes. In the resurrection, when God raises Jesus from the dead, we find all that Jesus had said, that he had come to seek the lost, that he had come to establish his kingdom, that he had come to give his life as a ransom for many. All of the things that you find in the Gospels is now vindicated by God raising him up. You know, in literature, sometimes it's said that the end of the story it reveals the final significance of all that had gone before it. Well, the end of Christ's story is the resurrection. That this one who died a shameful dead was raised from the dead and highly exalted. This resurrection says that God affirms, vindicates, stands behind all that you read in the Gospels. So he has been raised. And he is not here. He is not here. The angel even says to the women, come and look at the place where he was. And then later, we're told that when the women see Jesus, they grab hold of his feet and worship him. But he is not here. It is a bodily resurrection. I don't know how many of you know this English scholar, N.P. Wright. He probably has spent more time thinking, reflecting on the resurrection than any person alive. He has this one volume work, 800 pages, on the resurrection of the Son of God. And he makes the observation, and it's an important one, that the Gospels want us to know that the tomb was empty, that this was a bodily resurrection. And he says the significance of that is this. It was not the belief that Jesus had somehow survived death, that he now existed in some spiritual form. A bodily resurrection, he says it was part of the Judaism of the first century, that the resurrection of the body assumed the great resurrection. Not a disembodied state, but a re-embodied state. He says, for instance, that for the Old Testament, beginning already in Ezekiel, with the return of the exile, the resurrection heralded the great day when the people would be brought back, when the pall of death would be lifted, when all things would be well, when creation would be again in all its astonished glory. What so confused the first century Judaism was that they thought that when this happened, it would be a universal event, and the early churches, yes, but it's in a two-tier stage. It begins with this one, our representative being raised, and he becomes the prototype. He becomes the first fruit of a great harvest. His resurrection is a glance into the future. So that if the end is in fact what tells you about the significance of all that has gone before, then Christ's resurrection speaks of our end and tells us that in the end we will be glorified, splendid creatures, as Christ was when he was raised. In a little devotional that I was reading this week, the writer tells of an earthquake in China. And the earthquake caused these huge boulders along the side of cliffs to be moved or to roll away. And he says in one instance, there were this boulder that was removed, and it revealed this vast cave network underneath the mountain, and they discovered there a whole world of treasures and artifacts that were at least 1,000 years old. And the writer makes the observation that with the resurrection and the rolling away of the stone, we are given a glimpse into a whole new world. You're in my future, you see. He is not here, for he has been raised. God was involved in this affair, and he has made a new future possible. So that's the gift. And then the women, the angel says, "This is my message for you. This is my gift for you." And then the women, they leave the tomb quickly with fear and great joy to tell the disciples. Now what strikes me is really significant is that the receiving of the gift comes only by hearing. You must hear the message. It comes by hearing. Hearing the message. I think sometimes we think that the resurrection, it's just one more bit of information in our files. But as a matter of fact, the church must be continually hearing this. And I was thinking about that, and it's a bit like the language of love. You know, if this morning you said to your spouse or to your children, or you said to your parents, "I love you," your spouse or your parents didn't say, "Tell me something new, please." Old, same old, same old. No. In the language of love, to hear expressed, "I love you," to really hear it, it's to be energized. It's to be renewed. It triggers in you a similar response. And I love you. And it's not something that you should just sort of get weary of. See, sometimes when I talk to our young people, I get this weariness about the faith. It's as though, hey, we've heard this. Please tell us something new. And I want to say, there is nothing new but this. Hear it. The church is forever an unending community of hearing, of listening, so that the mystery of God and the mystery of the Spirit may work in our hearts and energize us and make us believe in our hearts and confess with our mouths that God did indeed raise Him from the dead, and that those who believe in Him will not be put to shame. It's a listening. It's a need to hear, an unending listening. And when they hear it, we're told that they are left with fear and great joy. So whether this is a good service or not, whether you and I have fully appreciated this gift of love, this amazingly sacrificial gift of love, the resurrection. I mean, in part it will be revealed to us in the presence of fear and great joy. And you know, as I was thinking about that, I realized that I wish that I was more acquainted with this fear. This fear. The women leaving with fear, you may say, psychologically it's understandable. After all, resurrections are not everyday occurrences. True, but this fear is not simply limited to the women. It has something to do with the fact that there's God. Think of it this way. Suppose you're doing some remodeling in your house, and before you start taking things apart, you shut off the electricity. At least you think you've shut off the main switch. And then you're going at it, and all of a sudden you get this powerful jolt. And you realize you didn't do the right switch, and that you were working with live wires. And suddenly, your work is not quite as safe. You see, and I'm thinking that you and I, we can live our lives in a very, very narrow world. We can be tyrannized by the present, by present-day duties. And we forget the reality of our existence. I mean, very simply, you and I, we forget, for instance, that we are sitting here on a fifth-grade planet, swirling around the sun, with the sun flying through the Milky Way, and with the Milky Way going through the vast spaces of the universe. We forget that. When you think about it, or you see it on a film, you almost want to hold on to your seats. But we can be so ignorant of our true circumstances. And now we are to be reminding ourselves that we are not only nestled in a faraway corner in the Milky Way, but that we are held by the hand of God. And isn't it true that now and again something of that significance breaks through into your life? And if not exactly fear or dread, there is a sense of awe and deep reverence. Easter wants us to realize that the mystery of our existence, that we are in the hands of God. A little footnote. I remembered as I was thinking about this, 10 of the best pages that I've ever read on horror movies and why our teenagers are so fascinated by them. It's in the book that's been written by a number of our members, Dancing in the Dark. And some say the fascination with scary films is that it's still a childhood leftover from being fascinated by things that go bump in the night and what might be in the closet. But they say at a deeper level, it is a desire. It is a desire to be reminded of another plane of existence, a transcendence, the other. And the great question whether the other is friend or foe, an ET or an alien or a Freddy Krueger. We live here on this tiny planet, swirling through space, controlled by none of us. And on Easter, we are reminded in a breathtaking way that this great universe is but a marble in the hand of God, and that He is intently interested in our welfare and in our well-being. And to know that, you know, so many of our... You remember Psalm 139, where can I go, but you are there, you know the thoughts of my heart. And I'm thinking, there are so many of my sinful desires that fly a false flag, that assume false names, so that greed becomes concern for family and children, and deceit, we call it cleverness, and anger and hate, we call it a real concern for justice and righteousness. There is so much falsehood in us, and the thought that there is one whose eyes are all seeing, whose face we must one day face, it can be an awe-inspiring reality that we have to do with God. So they hear the message, and they receive the gift. They hear the message, and they leave with fear and great joy. Great joy. Did you know, I think this is just so interesting, in Matthew 2, this very same phrase is used when the wise men finally see the star that tells them where the Christ is. They rejoice with a deep and profound joy. And now, for the second time, it's the women hearing the message, rejoicing with a deep and profound joy. Now, joy. I know we all want joy. What exactly does it mean to have joy? What would it mean to have a great joy? As I reflected on it, isn't it true that you know joy when you experience fulfillment? Am I right? A sense of fulfillment. Or you're on the way to fulfillment. Some task is nearly completed and you know joy. Some child smiles at you and you know joy. You're sailing down the channel and you know joy. It is those times where you say, it doesn't get any better than this. Or you say, this is what it's all about, isn't it? And what you think it's all about and what you think makes all the difference in the world may differ, but we all know this sense of joy which feels as though life has finally come to its fulfillment. The great theologian Karl Barth talked about joy as tiny Sabbath rests, where you say with Simeon, my eyes have seen your salvation. Now let your servant depart. To see Easter as the cause for fulfillment. You know, when John Audie was buried, we had this funeral service, of course, and one of his sons put these lines in the liturgy that had become so... I memorized them and I love them and I've used them before. But it's from Raymond Carver, a short storyteller. And the four lines are these. Did you get what you wanted out of life even so? I did. And what did you want? To call myself beloved and to feel beloved on the earth. To call myself beloved and to feel beloved on the earth. You see, and on Easter, on a day such as today, we are to remind ourselves, to say to ourselves and to each other and to the world, you are beloved by God. This world, it is beloved by God. Call yourself beloved and feel beloved. For God so loved you that he sent his son to die a shameful death, the death that you and I should have died, but raised him so that with him all creation might rise and sing glory hallelujah to the great Redeemer God. The gift, he has been raised. Receive that gift with fear and great joy, and worship the one who made it all happen. Amen.